From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For only the fourth time in United States history, articles of impeachment today unveiled by leaders of the House of Representatives.
The House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing two articles of impeachment, charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
Abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Those are the charges announced by House Judiciary Committee Chairman Democrat Gerald Nadler. House Intelligence Committee Chair Democrat Adam Schiff categorized today's announcement in historic terms.
The framers of the Constitution recognized that someday a president might come to office who would abuse that office, betray the public trust, and undermine national security to secure foreign help in his reelection, and who would seek to abrogate the power of Congress to hold him accountable. They recognized this danger, and they prescribed a remedy, and that remedy is impeachment.
While historic, this moment is also very much of this current time. Before any formal response came from the White House, the president himself took to Twitter this morning and said, quote, "To impeach a president who has proven through results, including producing perhaps the strongest economy in our country's history, to have one of the most successful presidencies ever, and most importantly, who has done nothing wrong, is sheer political madness. Hashtag 2020 election." So this hour on Point, the articles of impeachment. And you can join us now. You know, House Democrats are charging President Trump with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Do you agree? Have they made the case to impeach the president? Or do you think the president's right when he says this is, quote, political madness? Join us anytime online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, let's start right in Washington with Tolu Olurunipa, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, now we know the House Judiciary Committee has two articles of impeachment, not three. Tell us a little bit more about what Committee Chair Gerald Nadler said.
Yeah, there was a lot of interest in how broad this impeachment process was going to be, whether or not Democrats would bring in information from the Mueller report, whether or not they would include an obstruction of justice charge. They decided to keep it very narrow, focused on the president's dealings with Ukraine, which Democrats say are very clear instances of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Abuse of power because, in the words of the Democrats, the president used his official office to try to pressure Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 elections by announcing investigations into Joe Biden and his son. And then obstruction of Congress because the White House has taken an absolutist, complete presidential immunity approach, saying that they do not have to comply with any of the subpoenas from Congress. They do not have to comply with any of the investigative oversight responsibilities of Congress. And Democrats are saying that because the president has taken this position, he is declaring himself above the law, saying that he cannot be investigated by the legislative branch and he cannot be investigated by his own Justice Department. And because of that, they feel like they have to use this drastic approach of impeaching a president because not only did he abuse his power, but he also tried to cover it up by obstructing Congress. So those two articles are going to be how the Democrats move forward with what we expect to be a party line impeachment, but a historic event that they've announced that those two articles will be the basis for their impeachment process.
So tell us a little bit more about what the next immediate steps are. There needs to be debate, right, in the Judiciary Committee.
There will be debate. There will be a drafting process. I expect much of the drafting will happen behind closed doors. And we have to also remember what has gotten us here. We've had weeks of closed door hearings and then open public hearings, televised hearings, testimony from constitutional scholars, testimony from various staff members who put together reports to document all that we've seen so far. We've had back and forth in the courts trying to get some witnesses to testify. So there's been a lot building up to this, and what we're expected to see over the next couple of weeks is a pretty rapid process of actual language in which we see the language of the articles of impeachment, a markup process, debate within the Judiciary Committee, a vote which could take place as early as this week, which would send this to the House floor, and then all members of Congress could hold this historic impeachment vote before Christmas and send it over to the Senate, where we would expect a trial in January.
Now, we'll talk a lot more about how this week in the Judiciary Committee hearings, we may have had basically what amounts to a preview of what the debate across the whole House is going to look like here. But Tolu, do we have a formal response from the White House itself yet?
Well, usually we look to the president's Twitter account for these responses, and that has already been lighting up today. The president tweeted in all caps, witch hunt. He thinks that this entire process is a witch hunt. He's pushed back on the Democrats' argument that he pressured Ukraine. He's tried to quote the Ukrainian president, who has said that he did not feel pressured during this phone call with President Trump back in July, where President Trump asked the president of Ukraine to do us a favor and then said he wanted investigations of Democrats, of Biden. So the president is trying to defend himself. He's trying to say that what Democrats are pursuing is a political witch hunt. The White House has said that this is all part of a broader strategy of the Democrats to interfere with the 2020 elections by dinging the president with these investigations as he tries to campaign for re-election. So I expect that to continue to be their position, to not comply with various in investigative steps by the Democrats who are calling for witnesses, calling for people within the White House to come and testify, and instead to try to paint this as a political partisan effort while also trying to make sure that all Republicans remain on board and they don't lose one or two Republicans to this impeachment vote, which is expected over the next couple of weeks.
I see. Just, you know, we've got the president tweeting. He's going after Adam Schiff here, calling him a, quote, totally corrupt politician, making a horrible and fraudulent statements. That's from the president, and he also goes back on his Twitter feed to read the transcripts here. But interestingly, we're also I believe that there is some response coming from Brad Parscale, the campaign manager for President Trump's reelection campaign. I see him here. He made a statement just after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi began this morning's press conference, Brad Parscale saying, for months, Nancy Pelosi said she wouldn't move forward on impeachment because it was too divisive and needed bipartisan support. And then he goes on to say, well, it is divisive and only the Democrats are pushing it, but she's doing it anyway. Americans don't agree with this rank partisanship, but Democrats are putting this on the this political theater because they don't have a viable candidate for 2020 and they know it. So that's Brad Parscale, the president's reelection campaign manager. I mean, how much is the election factoring into the Democrats' decision to unveil these articles of impeachment today, Tolu?
Well, it's definitely factoring into the timing. The reason that the Democrats want to do this quickly is because there is an election coming up. You have several members of Congress who are Democrats who are going to be running for president. Some of them are expected to be in Iowa in the next several weeks as they prepare for the first caucus votes in early February. So part of the reason Democrats wanted to clear this off the plate so early is because there is a big major election coming up. They have said that because the president tried to get Ukraine to interfere in the next election, that they feel an urgency to make sure that they do this quickly so that the president doesn't feel that he has carte blanche to solicit interference in the upcoming election. But we've also seen President Trump and his campaign really try to capitalize on this and really try to hit Democrats very hard. We've seen these statements from Brad Parscale almost every day as every new development has happened in this impeachment process. He's really hit back against the Democrats, saying that they are pursuing a partisan impeachment, tying this to the 2020 election, saying that Democrats do not have a strong contender against President Trump and they feel that they need to try to impeach him to sully him before the election. So this is really being played on a political turf right now, with both parties really trying to dial up their partisan advantages and trying to see how they can strategize ahead of the 2020 election, even as this historic constitutional process plays out.
Mm. Well, Tolu Olurunipa, a White House correspondent or White House reporter for The Washington Post, hang on, Tolu, for just a moment here, because we're also going to bring in some legal scholars. First, let me turn to Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She is one of more than 500 legal scholars who have had signed an open letter stating the president engaged in impeachable conduct. And she joins us from Philadelphia. Professor Finkelstein, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So now that we know the two articles of impeachment that House Democrats have announced today, do you think we already know you support impeachment, but do you think these are the right ones?
These are absolutely the right ones. They cover the two sides of the president's misdeeds surrounding the Ukraine affair. On the one hand, abuse of his position as president to benefit himself which is not what presidents or any elected official should be doing. And the other side is obstructing the inquiry into those misdeeds when Congress tried to investigate. So he has intimidated and harassed witnesses. He's insulted and harangued the Democrats, calling them human scum. He's refused to allow members or former members of his administration to testify, and he's encouraged them to defy subpoenas. He's called the process a coup. And all of that adds up to attempting to obstruct the process rather than letting the process play itself out and try to demonstrate his innocence.
Mm. And what do you make of the fact that they didn't actually expand it beyond the testimony that we heard about the president's action vis-a-vis Ukraine, that issues from the Mueller report were not included in any of the articles of impeachment?
I have some reservations about that, but I understand it to be a strategic decision. They want to keep it simple for the American public. It's extremely complicated. There are misdeeds on so many fronts that I think they feel that it will just the American people will just be lost in a maze of pursuing different kinds of charges, and they want to keep it clear and simple. But I do have reservations about the fact, in particular, that emoluments violations were not added to this, because my concern is that it will signal to future presidents that it's okay to use your office for financial gain in the various ways that the president has, and that there will be no articles of impeachment following that kind of misbehavior.
Mm. Well, we are talking about today's historic announcement of two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump, and we want to know what you think. Do you believe the president did abuse his power, that he did obstruct Congress, or do you think the president's right when he says, in his words, this is a witch hunt? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the two articles of impeachment announced today by House Democrats against President Donald Trump, only the fourth time in U.S. history where articles of impeachment have been announced or unveiled against a president. And we want to know what you think. Is this the right move by House Democrats, as the full House will most likely eventually take up a debate over articles of impeachment, or are you with the president when he says this is a sham and a wish hunt? We're joined today by Tolu Olurunipa. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Claire Finkelstein is with us as well. She's a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. And joining us now is David Schultz. He's a visiting professor of law at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches constitutional law. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University as well. Professor Schultz, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So I'll ask you the same question that I asked Professor Finkelstein here. What is your first take on these two specific articles of impeachment unveiled by House Democrats today?
Well, what I want to do is sort of reframe it a little bit and sort of pose two points here. One is to ask the question whether or not the impeachment process is the right way of deterring the president's behavior. And that's my second point, is going to be to say that it's going to be hard to justify the president's behavior, but the question is, is impeachment the right remedy for it, and do his actions rise to a level of removing him from office? And those are really the questions here. And let me address both of them quickly. Is that we we're suspecting we're going to get a party line impeachment vote in the House of Representatives. It's going to go over to the Senate. We're going to probably get a party line acquittal in the Senate. And the question becomes at that point, what has the House of Representatives and what have the Democrats accomplished? And if their goal is to deter presidential behavior, I'm not sure that's going to have accomplished it. So that's the first issue. The second issue is in terms of, has he done something that rises to the level of saying that he should be removed from office? And that also, I'm not sure he's convinced, or rather the Democrats have convinced the American public yet. If I can do an analogy here, even though the impeachment process is not a criminal process, for all of us who've watched too many cops and robbers shows, we know in a criminal trial, it's beyond a reasonable doubt is the standard. I'm going to argue that in order to remove a president, you need something far beyond a reasonable doubt. And we may not have reached that point yet with the American public to convince them. So I think at this point, the Democrats' strategy in terms of moving for impeachment is not going to secure their goals, and they don't have the American public behind them in terms of being able to move on this issue. And that becomes a complication going into 2020, especially if he gets the likely acquittal. How does that, let's say, embolden the president going into 2020?
Tolu Olorunipa, since you're there following the story closely in Washington as White House reporter, do you think Democrats feel, or are they concerned, maybe even behind closed doors, about what David Schultz is saying, that they may not have the American people behind them as they press forward in this process?
Well, I think it's important to note that no one really knows how this is going to play out politically, just because President Trump is such a strange and abnormal political figure. He was able to defy a lot of the laws of political atmospherics in 2016 and even during his presidency. And the fact that Democrats won in 2018 has given them some confidence that they know the politics of the moment and that they feel that they have at least a large percentage of the American people behind them. But I do think that's part of the reason they kept this narrow and they didn't include some of the other things like emoluments and the Mueller probe and the president's potential campaign finance violations back in 2016 with hush money payments, because they wanted to try to keep this narrow, try to keep it focused, try not to allow it to drag out and not allow Republicans to make the case that they are just out to get the president, that they don't want to cooperate with him, that they see impeachable conduct in everything that he does, and that they disagree with him, and they're using the major significant constitutional process of impeachment to voice their political differences or their policy differences. So I do think there is some awareness among the Democrats that they could push this too far and that there could be political blowback. We have seen in a previous impeachment with Bill Clinton that, you know, Republicans who pursued that impeachment, a lot of them lost their seats in the House and they did not have a good election after that process played out, and a lot of them came to regret it. So there is some of that residue among Democrats, but there is also the sense that they feel that they have this constitutional obligation to hold President Trump accountable because he has felt so bold to, you know, solicit investigations from another foreign government, even after the whole Russia probe played out.
Right. So Claire Finkelstein, let me turn to you here, but I do want to just play some tape to reflect sort of how this issue of process really was front and center in the Judiciary Committee hearings earlier this week. So here is House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler addressing Republican critique of the impeachment process in his opening statement during yesterday's hearing.
The president's supporters are going to argue that this whole process is unfair. The record before us is clear on this point as well. We invited the president to participate in this hearing, to question witnesses, and to present evidence that might explain the charges against him. President Trump chose not to show. He may not have much to say in his own defense, but he cannot claim that he did not have an opportunity to be heard.
That's House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler yesterday. Well, also yesterday, Ranking Member Doug Collins, Georgia Republican, in his opening statement, he insisted that the impeachment hearings are essentially much ado about nothing.
There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here?
That's Ranking Member Doug Collins in the House Judiciary Committee. So, Claire Finkelstein, respond to what you're hearing here. I guess the question is, you know, process an issue?
Yeah. Well, so I want to respond to David's comments earlier, which is about the strategy. I mean, given that the facts are so undeniable, the witnesses that testified, the civil servants, couldn't have been clearer and couldn't have been more straightforward in speaking with a single voice that, in fact, the president did hold up military aid to Ukraine in order to try to induce President Zelensky to make a statement that Biden was being investigated. That there is no doubt that that occurred. It is open and shut. And I think there is also no doubt that that is an impeachable offense. And I think everyone knows it. So the real puzzle is, why isn't there greater support? Why haven't any of the Republicans in the House or the Senate come around to support this? And I think it's very important to look at the role that obstruction itself has played in the ability of the Democrats in the House to really make the case. What would they have had to do to start changing Republican opinion? I think they would have had to get Don McGahn in there. They would have had to get a number of other people, maybe Rudy Giuliani, maybe Mick Mulvaney. They would have had to strike at the core of Trump's administration or his past administration, get John Bolton in there. And why haven't they been able to do that? They haven't been able to do that because the president has obstructed that effort. So unfortunately, I think that the idea that we can just send this over now to the Senate and that there's any prayer of a chance that without that testimony, Republicans in the Senate will come around, I think is wishful thinking. In that sense, I agree with David, but I don't think it's because the American people haven't come around. In fact, polls have shown that a majority of the American people are supportive of impeachment. The real issue is why Republicans in the House and the Senate haven't changed their mind on this issue, given the strength of the evidence. Now, I think it's important to identify here Devin Nunes.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the fact that he himself was apparently quite inappropriately, possibly illegally, involved in contact with Ukraine and in supporting the president's efforts here. When you have a member of Congress who is actually supporting the president's abuse of power, it should not be so puzzling that, in fact, House Republicans haven't come around on this issue. So I would have preferred that the Democratic leaders spend more time to really push back on the president's obstruction. And I think they could still do that before they send it over to the Senate in order to make the case stronger and allow for some possibility of turning Republicans in the Senate in their favor.
Okay, so David Schultz then responds specifically on this question of obstruction. I mean, I'm going to lean on both you and Claire and Tolu as the experts here, but I can't recall the absolutism that we've seen from this particular White House in its non-cooperation in previous administrations. Maybe Nixon, but do you not think that the level of lack of cooperation or obstruction, as Claire is saying, that does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense?
Well, there's no question that he's taken an absolutist position. And if we actually look at sort of the case law, anywhere from, you know, the famous U.S. versus Nixon case, which was all about executive privilege in the Watergate tapes, the Supreme Court and lower courts have said that the president doesn't have an absolute prerogative or executive privilege. And so on that score, I think the case law is clear. But where I'm just going to sort of make a devil's advocate argument here is to say that the president is challenging lots of these positions, these subpoenas in court. Arguably, one can say that that these are questions that are open that may be revisited by the court, and maybe he's got some kind of facial defense to say that until such time as the courts have ruled against him, this is not obstruction of justice, but that instead it is what? The president trying to to defend Article II presidential power. Now, I'm not sure if that's a great argument, but that's possibly an argument. But what I want to come back to here is for those of us who are old enough to remember the Nixon hearings, Senate and House Judiciary, it was an educative process to the American public. And partly what I've been getting at before is to say that I don't think the Democrats have taken enough time to educate enough of the American public about what's going on here. And with that, also keep in mind, and this becomes, I think, something that I think a lot of us can talk about and agree to, is that the conditions of 1974 with Nixon, 98 with Clinton are so different now with the degree of polarization in our society that I'm just not sure that anything that the Democrats can do in the House is going to change minds of Republicans in the House or the Senate, which again leads to the question of what does this process actually accomplish in terms of deterring the president of the United States?
Okay, Professor Schultz, let me just follow up with that, because this is something that we're hearing day in and day out. Political polarization is so profound, it's so deep, perhaps unbridgeable in the United States in 2019 going into 2020. Therefore, would any process change any minds? I mean, does that not call into question the sort of the fundamental centrality of the articles of the Constitution that lay out that this is the process? This is the only process we actually have, or one of the only processes the nation actually has at its disposal, as written in the Constitution. We can't just say, like, because we're currently politically polarized, let's toss out what the founders intended, can we?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I just taught this past semester at the University of Minnesota a seminar on the impeachment process. And we sort of talked about the fact that what we're really looking at this point is a constitution that presupposed some shared consensus or shared values that we saw even with Clinton and Nixon in terms of cooperation, respect for checks and balances and separation of powers. All that is broken down here. And on the one hand, you could say, well, heck, let's just sort of go ahead with it, do the impeachment process anyhow, but sort of let the chips fall where they may, because we have to do that. But on the other hand, maybe there are other mechanisms that are out there. Maybe they're not good. Maybe there is, for example, and I made an argument in the Hill a couple of weeks ago that perhaps censure is the opportunity in terms of going after the president that way, in terms of rebuking him. Maybe it's making the case that way and then running against the president very vigorously in 2020 and defeating him. I think we're at a point right now where there are so many problems in terms of where the polarization has broken down our constitutional mechanisms that there really isn't a good, viable alternative at this point.
Claire Finkelstein, what do you think about that?
Well, I disagree with a couple of points. First of all, impeachment's really the only game in town. I mean, given that the Justice Department has said and will not reconsider the principle that a sitting president cannot be indicted, that effectively puts the president above the law unless he can be impeached. I don't think censure would mean anything to this administration, and I don't think Republicans would go along with that either. I also disagree that the problem is the failure to educate the American people. I don't think the issue is with the American people as much as it is with our elected representatives. In other words, I think that House and Senate Republicans are actually out of touch with the American people. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a core of Trump supporters that will support him almost no matter what. But I think that the Republicans are our elected representatives are out of touch, and they're out of touch for an important reason, which is this president has an extraordinary ability to capture and corrupt individuals who he deals with on a regular basis. It's amazing. One wonders how he manages to do it. But everyone who he has dealt with is either falls into his corruption or else gets expelled from his administration or from his orbit. And once again, I think we see something like that with Devin Nunes, and you wonder how deep it goes in either the House or the Senate. But I think it's not explicable on the basis of the facts, the law, and where the American people are. It's explicable on crossing lines between the White House and the Senate and the House in ways that the framers never anticipated. They expected that these branches would stay in their lanes, and it appears that they haven't.
Well, totally.
Can I throw a question here?
Yeah, David Schultz, I'll let you do that after we take a quick break here.
Sure.
But before that break, I just wanted to give Tolu a minute here because Claire Finkelstein has mentioned Devin Nunes twice now. And I just, Tolu, to help us all stay educated on this, can you tell us a little bit more about why Devin Nunes's name has come up repeatedly in the past week beyond his actual service on these committees?
Devin Nunes is a ranking Republican member, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee. And as part of the Democrats' impeachment report that came out of the Intelligence Committee, we learned that Devin Nunes had been in touch with several people, some of questionable character who were pushing some of these conspiracy theories about Ukrainian election meddling, disparaging the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine. A couple of these folks have already been indicted for campaign finance issues. So the fact that Devin Nunes was in touch with some of these people makes it likely that his role in this entire process is going to be questioned even more. And there's going to be questions about whether he should have recused himself as being one of the president's top defenders on the Intelligence Committee.
Well, we have to take a quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about today's historic announcement by House Democrats unveiling two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. The articles of impeachment are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. And we had a very quick reaction from House Republicans today following the Democratic press conference this morning. Here's ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, Doug Collins, a Georgia Republican, dismissing the announcement of the articles of impeachment. He was on Fox News.
Well, it's just amazing. I saw nothing, but it's very telling that they all walked off stage and didn't answer a question. That, to me, is really telling. Why would the Speaker of the House, you just announced articles of impeachment, you had your five committee chairs, you had Adam Schiff, you had Jerry Nadler, you had, and they wouldn't take questions? I mean, that tells me that they're really not inherently comfortable with what they're doing.
That's Georgia Republican Congressman Doug Collins this morning on Fox News. Well, yesterday, during the House Judiciary Committee hearing, Democrats did telegraph why they feel a particular sense of urgency in this moment to act, to unveil those articles of impeachment. Here's Democratic Counsel Barry Burke making the case. Again, this was yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee, making the case that impeachment is an urgent matter not only for this presidency, but for those to come.
Our imagination is the only limit to what President Trump may do next or what a future president may do next to try to abuse his or her power to serve his own personal interest over the nation's interest.
That's Democratic Counsel Barry Burke yesterday. I'm joined today by Tolu Olurunipa. He's a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Claire Finkelstein is with us as well. She's a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. And David Schultz joins us. He's a visiting professor of law at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches constitutional law. And David, before the break, you wanted to pose a question here.
I want to pose two. One, I'm going to contest the idea that, in fact, the Republicans are out of step with the American public. And that if we look at the polling data, that yes, in general, support for impeachment dovetails with support for Donald Trump. But if we start to look at the spatial distribution of support for Donald Trump and spatial distribution for support for Republicans, we have to keep in mind that what? The Republicans who are supporting impeachment are what? Largely getting their clues from their constituents who largely oppose impeachment for the president. And so in some sense, I think exactly what the members of who are Republicans of Congress are doing is dovetailing exactly what their constituents believe. Two, I'm just going to throw a question out here. What do the Democrats do and what does the House of Representatives do the day after acquittal in the Senate by Donald Trump?
Claire, would you like to answer that?
Well, I am worried about that as well. And which is why I think that it would be a strategic error for the Democrats to just send this over to the Senate in the current state that it is in. I don't think they have had the right witnesses. They had excellent witnesses in the civil servant, but they haven't had enough witnesses. And they haven't had key witnesses. In addition to members of the administration, I think they should have called in some national security experts and members of the military to really explain what this does to our national security. They've mentioned it over and over, but that's not something that the law professors were really in a position to explain. They were explaining why these facts fit impeachment and what the history of impeachment is. But the American public has been concerned about national security, and indeed, Republicans in the Senate, even Mitch McConnell, were very vocal when Trump announced the decision to pull troops out of Syria. So I think it shows that Americans do have an understanding of the national security peril that this places the United States in. And that is something that needs to be brought into the hearings in a very clear way so that people can understand.
So, Tolu, help us understand this. This has come up before. I mean, why didn't, to Claire's point, why didn't House Democrats call more witnesses in the judiciary hearings? What was the rush?
Well, they are operating under a political calendar. We are less than a year away from the next presidential election. And you've heard from several Republicans who have said, even if what the president did was wrong, we're going to have an election in just a few months. Let's let the American people decide. And Democrats face the challenge of trying to get people to go through court battles, which we've already seen in some of the court battles over the president's taxes, over trying to get Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, to testify. These court battles can take months on end. Those court battles are still ongoing, and they started very early this year. So they didn't think that they had enough time to watch all of those court battles play out, potentially win some of those court battles, and then get testimony from top officials months after, and potentially even up to a year after some of the major events that are under scrutiny would have happened. So they felt like they have the momentum at the moment. We do have a presidential campaign that's getting ready to start in earnest next year. And for Democrats' position, they've made the calculation that it was better to proceed with what they have, including a lot of very voluminous testimony from witnesses, some firsthand, some secondhand, but generally all in agreement with the idea that the president did something that was not appropriate when it came to withholding aid from Ukraine while also pursuing political investigations. So Democrats faced that calculation and they made the decision that they felt it was better to move with what they have, keep the momentum going, get this over to the Senate, and make sure they're able to pass this these articles of impeachment before things fizzle out, before, as what we saw with the Mueller report, people start to forget about it, people move on to other scandals, and it doesn't have the same level of motivating force that it might have right in the moment, right after some of these major people have already testified. And so rather than waiting for those other witnesses who have so far defied subpoenas to move forward, they have decided to proceed with what they have and build their case based on the witnesses that they were able to obtain.
Right. So, David,
jump in here very quickly? Let's think for a moment about what would happen if the election came and went and Trump were reelected and the Senate has changed, and then the trial in the Senate happens then. Why would that be so bad? I mean, granted, there's an urgency because of what he keeps doing and because of the continued misdeeds and the continued obstruction. But it's not clear to me that this has to be done before the election. I think the biggest risk is that the election will come and he'll lose and we'll miss the chance to impeach him, which is really important because we have to push back at this. But I don't think that's a worry that House Democrats are that concerned about. They seem to be in a hurry to do this before the election, and I think they might want to reconsider that.
Of course, Claire, many people are saying that the best way to have a referendum on the president is the election itself. But David Schultz, let me turn back to you, because you asked this question about what happens on the day after if there's a Senate trial of President Trump and he is acquitted. What happens? What do Democrats do the day after? Isn't one response exactly what the Republicans did the day after Bill Clinton was acquitted during his Senate trial and his impeachment? The processes are allowed to be played out. The Constitution is adhered to. A fair trial happens in the Senate. A verdict is issued, and the nation moves on. Is that not a possible answer here? We've been through this before.
Right. That is a possible answer. But if we're now going back to the whole point, I think, in part of what the Democrats and some of the witnesses were talking about yesterday, about deterring the president's behavior, about saying that there's certain things that he's doing shouldn't be allowed to happen, that acquittal basically does what? It basically exonerates the president in terms of saying that the tendering of U.S. military aid for personal political advantage was actually okay, or B, that the president did nothing wrong and he gets to run on that. So I think that becomes the other danger in terms of moving on the process the way they're moving it right now. I think so that's one argument. The flip side I want to get at here is that I think the Republicans are making a strategic mistake right now in terms of criticizing the process in the House, because once it goes over to the Senate, it's equally going to be, I think, almost a circus over there also, because imagine scenarios in terms of where people such as Joe Biden are effectively put on trial. Maybe we start to see some of the conspiracy theories brought out. I think we're going to see now a flip side where the Democrats say that this wasn't a fair trial, that it was biased from the start. So I'm not sure if we're going to be able to move on the day afterwards and say fair process, fair trial, a just verdict was reached. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to walk away from this with everybody equally mad.
Yeah, point well taken, David Schultz. We have a statement here from the White House. The White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham saying, quote, "The announcement of two baseless articles of impeachment does not hurt the president. It hurts the American people. The president will address these false charges in the Senate and expects to be fully exonerated because he did nothing wrong." That's a statement from White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham. Now, our callers have been very patiently waiting here and using our alternative number. So let me see if I can just get a couple of them in before we run out of time. Let's go to Robert, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'm not a Biden person, but he's really right that this is about the soul of the nation. We've been exposed to this naked corruption since 2017, even 2015. This Ukraine episode is just the latest. People and Congress, they need to decide which side of history they're going to be on. If they're going to be on the side of corruption or the side that opposes corruption. And about the smokescreen, the arguments that they're putting up, really there are three things. A person can have integrity and virtue. A person can have, that's one. A person can have intellect, that's two. Or a person can support this corrupt, mendacious, narcissistic demagogue. You can have two of the three. You cannot have all three.
Robert, thank you for your call. Let's go to Darrell, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Darrell, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just think that it's a war against the parties, really. The Republican Party is proving their unconditional loyalty to Donald Trump in spite of the articles of impeachment that have been proven through many witness testimonies under the Constitution. But I think the biggest disadvantage that the Constitution allowed is the fact for it to go to an opposing witness decision with the opposing party. Because regardless of right or wrong, the party is going to vote loyalty to the president regardless of whether the facts prove otherwise.
Right. Well, Durrell, thank you so much for your call. David Schultz, you want to respond to him?
Well, In some sense, I'm going to reinforce, I think what he's saying here is that, again, the party discipline, party loyalty is so great at this point that, you know, I just don't see any system in place at this point that's going to impeachment process that's going to find him, you know, guilty of any articles of impeachment, which is why, even though I think the framers did intend clearly, and I agree with Claire that the whole the framers had impeachment here, the check abuses of presidential power here. What's happened is that instead of checks and balances overriding partisanship, partisanship now is overriding checks and balances. And that's a dangerous place where we are in American politics
yes,
now.
Yes, if I may, you're saying people are putting party over country. I mean, that is a broken nation, is it not? That's a broken democracy, David Schultz. That's what you're describing.
It is a broken it's a broken democracy, and this is exactly why George Washington's 1796 farewell address to the American public becomes incredibly sort of, you know, prescient at this point, where he worried about those days, and that's exactly where we are at this point right now. And I don't see any incentive structures in place right now that are going to change that preference of party over the country, and that's not good for our country.
Claire Finkelstein, in that case, does that not make using the only constitutional tools to hand even more urgent then?
Yeah. I mean, I want to say it's not just party over country. What's really going on is executive authority. There's been a steady expansion in executive authority really from Vietnam on, but especially since 9/11. And it happened under Bush. It happened under Obama. And, of course, the Democrats didn't complain as executive authority continued to expand. And through those years, and I run a center on national security and the rule of law, and I was concerned about it then, concerned about the degree to which Obama felt free to expand the role of executive authority and his commander-in-chief power with a increasingly weak and non-vocal Congress. And now the chickens are coming home to roost on that. It has been a long time in the making. Courts have been overly deferential to executive authority. Congress has been overly deferential. And now we are paying the price for that.
Well, Tolu, we've got about a minute left here. What do you see coming down the line in the next couple of days and weeks?
I think the script here has largely been written. The Democrats are likely to pass a mostly party line impeachment, two articles, send them over to the Senate where there will be a trial, and President Trump is likely to be acquitted, mostly on party lines as well, because of that high bar of you needing two-thirds of the Senate in order to convict and remove a president. But I don't want to undercut or sort of downplay how major and how significant it is that we are, as a country, about to impeach a president. It's only happened a couple of times in our history. It is something that, even if the president is acquitted, will go on his record the same way that Bill Clinton is known. It's only one of a couple of presidents in modern history that have been impeached, and history did not look kindly on his actions, even though he was acquitted by the Senate. So we're doing something historic as a country, and I think the American people will have to watch and learn from this process as it plays out. Even if much of the process is broken, history is being made.
And even participate in the process by telling their elected officials what they want for their nation. Well, Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Finkelstein, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
And David Schultz, visiting professor of law at the University of Minnesota, where he teaches constitutional law. Professor Schultz, it was terrific to have you as well. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.